Okay, gotcha.
Good evening. Welcome to Passionate Internet Voices Talk Radio, Inc., a league of nations among other internet radio stations, voices of the people united we roar. Today is February 14th, 2007. Happy V-Day. Happy Heart Day. Happy Valentine's Day. Happy Red Day. Happy even though it's cold and frigid here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. But we are not going to worry about it because tonight we have a special treat. Tonight we are joined by the last word in romance, the smartest, most savvy authors and experts in the most romantic fiction of all today are with us to talk about top romantic reads for those in a Valentine's night mood. And what is hot and wild in the romance aisles? Sexy excerpts, opinions, compelling reviews, dating tips, and strong views about love scenes. Ah, these ladies can tell it all.
Thank you, Lillian. It's such an honor and a privilege to be here tonight. My name is Rowena Cherry. I'm the author of Alien Abduction Romances with Sexy Chess Titles, and I will be acting as Mistress of Ceremonies tonight. So if I can introduce my smart and romantically expert guests in alphabetical order, and we will go... Oh, and the two I'd expected to introduce first aren't here. I'll tell you who we hope will still come. We're hoping Christy Alice will be able to join us. She is author of The Trouble with French Kisses and The Trouble with Belgian Waffles and Gabriel's Love, Midsummer's Magic, and Dance of Love. Christy is best known to me as a member of the Reviewers International Organization, a very well-respected reviewer for Romantic Times, and as an Amazon reviewer, Christy is ranked in the top 100. Now, just to give listeners an idea of how important that is, I've only written two very modest reviews, and my rank is 1,497,000. So I would have welcomed Christy, but she's not here yet. But hopefully she will turn up so we know what The Trouble with French Kisses actually is. Another author that we're waiting for is one of the hottest rising stars in both historical and paranormal romance today, Deborah Ann McGillivray, and I think she's currently a finalist in line for about 5 awards. Deborah McGillivray can be found at http://www.deborahmcgillivray.co.uk. She's the author of one of the highest debut books for Kensington Zebra Books, A Restless Night, also The Invasion of Forgannon Island for Dorchester, and she has works in progress called In Her Bed and Riding the Thunder. And she is a top 30 reviewer for Amazon. Now, next in alphabetical order, and I know Kenda's here, we have Kenda Montgomery. You can find Kenda at www.amazon.com if you search in the people section for K. Montgomery and then look for a self-portrait. There are a lot of K. Montgomerys. Kenda is a reviewer for Amazon.com and for Highland Press and for TheMysticCastle.com. She is also author of a short story called Mysterious Ways, coming soon from Highland Press's second time around anthology. Welcome, Kenda.
Hi. Really great to be here with y'all tonight. Just looking really forward to this chat.
And I know that Deborah and Jackie are particularly pleased that you're here, because you have very kindly agreed to read their sexy excerpts a little later on.
Sure, and I'll try to do justice to them.
Will you also be giving us a taste of Mysterious Ways, Kenda?
I can do that, or I can, if someone else wants to read it, they can, but I can certainly do that. I do have something picked out.
Well, splendid. So I think later on we'll ask you to read some Mysterious Ways.
Perfect.
That is so wonderful. Now we have another author and reviewer here with a title I can't wait to read, but I'm going to have to wait because it's not out yet, and that is Jackie Rogers, who can be found at http://www.jackierogers.com. She is a 2006 Pearl Award nominee for the Best Short Story and Best Anthology as an author for Fairy Good Advice. She also has written fairy special romances, also When Mules Rush In, which is in the Blue Moon Enchantment Anthology. Oh, I've just heard. Jackie isn't able to be with us either. The fairies got her. However, in their place, they have sent us Keely, a southern fairy. Keely, from Fairy Good Advice, can you give us any words of wisdom for Valentine's Day?
Oh, be with your lover.
Oh, well, that was short and sweet. Wonderful advice. To learn more
We are not prepared to give advice. However, are you aware that I have a Hollywood star?
Do tell.
You just have to go to my blog. That's at keelysfairygoodadvice.blogspot.com, and you will see my Hollywood star. Of course, we haven't actually got it poured yet, but that is a facsimile.
Very nice. And is Diane Wiley here?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, splendid. Diane Wiley, who can be found at http://www.dianewiley.com, is the author of My Enemy, My Love, and Secrets and Sacrifices, and a short story, A Soldier to Love. Diane is a 2006 CAPA Award nominee from the Romance Studio for the Love Anthology, also an April 2006 Publisher's Pick for Writing Excellence for her Whiskey Creek Press book, For My Enemy, My Love. Diane, welcome. Would I be right in thinking that all your historical romances are set against a military backdrop, Diane?
That's absolutely correct, Rowena. Soldiers hold a special place in my heart because my husband is a Vietnam veteran. So I try to express the love that I have for him together with my fascination with the Civil War period in all of my books. My Enemy, My Love tells the story from the northern side of the war, and Secrets and Sacrifices from the southern side of the U.S. Civil War.
Oh, that's really cool. And what is it that fascinates you about the Civil War era? What's romantic and sexy about that, Diane?
Oh, lots of things. It was just a time of color and passion, a time when people like Scarlett O'Hara and Rhett Butler just take over our imaginations with their beautiful ball gowns and handsome men in uniform. Who doesn't love a man in uniform? Charlotte and Daniel of Secrets and Sacrifices, my latest release, tell a story of a life that's torn by war and ripe with opportunities for love during a time when happiness really was hard to find for people.
Oh, wow. Well, that sounds really great, Diane, and we'll look forward to having an excerpt a little later on. Well, what a broad, wonderful, sweeping range of talent we have here, from medieval Scotland and Knights of the England of Edward Longshanks, which is what Deborah MacGillivray writes, through America's Civil War and modern day, to my own alien gods from outer space. With French kisses, pagan customs, poker-playing cats, and I hope we'll get to some of those later, fairies and mysterious ways thrown in, which seems the perfect segue for an excerpt from the anthology No Law Against Love. The reviewer Detra Fitch wrote, "If you've ever found yourself rolling your eyes at some of the more stupid laws, then you are going to adore this novel. Over 25 stories fill up this anthology, each one dealing with at least one stupid or outdated law. Let me give you an example," Detra Fitch writes. "In Florida, USA, there is a law that states if an elephant is left tied to a parking meter, the parking fee has to be paid just as it would for a vehicle. In Great Britain, a license is required to keep a lunatic." So I'm going to call on Kenda in a few moments. Kenda finds her place to read an excerpt from Jackie's Fairy Good Advice from No Law Against Love, starring a fairy named Keely. But then I'd like to ask the fairy Keely, which silly law your author chose? Can you set up this excerpt for us?
Well, naturally, if it's illegal for a virgin to, for a man to have sex with a virgin, regardless of her marital status, we have a big problem with virgin brides, don't we? I mean, they can't make love, where the groom will be thrown in jail. So obviously, we needed a travel service to get the virgins to the virgin out of the virgin protection zone. And of course, nobody's better qualified than me to set that up. Obviously,
being a fairy
and all.
And where is this law? If
it's,
I may just
actually on the books in Auburn, Washington today.
And good gracious, in Auburn, Washington.
Yes, but I have researched this, of course, and my friends in Auburn tell me there's not a virgin to be found, so I don't think that they adhere to this law very well.
That's very funny. So, Kenda, do you have the text in front of you?
I sure do.
All right. If you are ready.
I am, and away we go. Auburn, Washington, shortly after the frozen time. Not a single soul had come into Virgin Freedom Travel all morning. I had more bills on my desk than fleas on a troll. The rent was due a week ago last Friday. I stared at the ominously silent phone, hoping Auburn Bell hadn't shut it off yet. My back ached, and I'd given my left fairy wing to lean back on a pillow. Okay, not. I'm very proud of my wings, translucent they are, and larger than most women's. Size does matter. The phone rang, and I snatched it up. Good morning. Virgin Freedom Travel. Keeley speaking. Where may I zap you? Do you plan only virgin honeymoon packages? A timid female voice queried. No, we also offer other honeymoon travel services that others, say, Purity Agency, don't. Is there an extra charge if you know you zap a bride outside of the virgin protection zone and she's not a virgin? Yeah. No extra charge, but you'd better be thinking about what you're going to tell your fiancé. I prided myself on my sensitive counseling abilities. Click. Okay, so I blew that one. I could have kicked myself. Luckily, the phone rang again. I answered in my most polite and professional voice. My fiancé just called, but she forgot to give you my credit card number. His baritone oozed over me like syrup on a hot pancake. Oh, my. I didn't want to tell him that his fiancé hadn't actually booked a trip, and I sure didn't want to tell him why. Your name, please? We have several associates, and I'll find out which one worked with your fiancé. Tyler Grant. He sounded impatient, but I still basked in the sexy low timbre of his voice. Listen, I'm busy, so just take my info and give it to the person who's booking the virgin honeymoon trip. But... end of basking. I grabbed a pen as he began rattling off his address and credit card number. He didn't give me his phone number, but I could get that off caller ID if I needed it, which I doubted. Thank you, Mr. Grant. Tyler, I'll give this to your fiancé's travel agent. After he cut the connection, I leaned back and pressed the back of my hand to my brow in an effort to forestall an impending headache. I felt a doozy coming on. I wonder why I ever decided to go into business for myself, especially the virgin transport business, the trickiest of all. Auburn City Council had discussed striking the deflowering ban from its books, but doing so would put me and many others out of business. Thankfully, Auburn was still a virgin protection zone, one of the few left in the United States. The phone rang again. Instinctively, I reached for the handset. Then I hesitated, my wings twitching. I smelled trouble. Good morning, Freedom Travel. This is Keely. I can't get married, the young woman's panicky voice sounded shrill. She also sounded like Tyler's fiancé. Relax. You can work things out. I'm so good at this. I smiled to myself. Not every bride is a virgin. Most men aren't that concerned about it. She sobbed, then blew her nose. I held the phone away from my ear for a moment of nose-blowing privacy. I'm sure you can work it out. It's not that. It's, well, he's gone a lot. And? She cleared her throat. A lot. And I'm going to have a baby. The sobs overtook her again. And the baby's not his. Yes, I mean, no, the baby's not his. I can't marry him because I'm going to marry Colin. Tell Tyler the wedding's off, and I'm sick or something. Click. A couple of aspirin would help a lot, and a shot of Jack Daniels. The phone rang again. I really didn't want to answer that phone. I glanced at the caller ID. Tyler Grant. Big surprise. Good morning. About that virgin honeymoon... make it Cancun, Mexico, instead of Thailand. But make sure you book dinner reservations at Riviera Maya. Tyler, I have another call. Talk to you later. Click. I stared at the phone. For 2 cents, I'd crush it. The mailman backed up to the door and pushed his way in with his butt. sorting mail as he did so. More bills. I just bring them. I don't send them. He handed me a stack of envelopes. Have a good day, his sing-song voice trailed behind him, echoing in the room. A good day, eh? I resisted the urge to whisk the whole darn mess of bills into the round file. The top envelope was from my landlord's attorney. The phone rang again. Tyler. Good morning. Did you book the Virgin Hollow honeymoon trip yet? I'm not about to get thrown in jail for 5 years over some technicality. No, sir, there's been a complication, as in he wouldn't be deflowering any virgins in the foreseeable future. And that would be, I think you should call your girlfriend. She said she didn't care where we went. Is there a problem with Cancun? I swear this man can make a woman swoon with his voice alone. No? Then book it. What dates? Why, Valentine's Day, of course. For 2 weeks. The best hotel, the best restaurants, the most exclusive tours. Let me know which airline you're booking with. I have frequent flyer miles. Click. My commission on a trip like this would be a nice chunk of change. I stared at the envelope from my landlord's attorney. I dared not open it. I knew exactly what he wanted. 3 months back rent and a security deposit I had never paid. Tyler's trip would cover my rent and the overdue phone bill, too. But it wouldn't be right. I punched the caller ID button and wrote down Tyler's number. He had to be told, even if his chicken-hearted ex-fiancé wouldn't do it. The phone rang before I worked up the courage to call. This is Muffy from Auburn Bell. I could have bottled her cherry voice and sold it to Disney. You may be aware your phone bill is a bit overdue. If you don't have payment in our office by Friday, I'm afraid we're going to have to shut it off. I bet that made her day. Thank you, Muffy. The computer stared at me as if daring me to book the trip. A couple of keystrokes, a few clicks of the mouse, and voila. I'd have enough money to pay my rent and Muffy, too. And Tyler would pay for a solo virgin honeymoon. We fairies take our word as our honor. The problem was, I hadn't said much. I rubbed the hologram tattoo on my forearm, hoping it would give me a hint as to what I should do. It didn't. My fiancé hadn't waited for an answer when she told me... His fiancé hadn't waited for an answer when she told me to give Tyler the news. As for Tyler, he'd done all the talking, and all the assuming, too. So I booked the Virgin honeymoon trip starting the next week, on Valentine's Day, for two, and watched the electronics funds transfer land in my bank account. A few more keystrokes and Virgin Freedom Travel's rent and phone were paid to current. This called for a bagel with real cream cheese, or my Lanta. The phone, that Muffy would no longer have the pleasure of shutting off, rang. Tyler again. Good morning. Whew, what a busy day. Did you get the trip booked? Yes, I did. Good, I'll be over Friday night to check the itinerary. In person? Do you have an objection to that? No. 7 o'clock, I'll bring Chinese takeout. Click. I swore to teach that man to end a phone call properly or choke him until his eyeballs popped out. It was Tuesday morning, nearly noon, actually. I had 3 full days to book more trips and earn enough money to refund Tyler's booking. Actually, he'd have to stop talking and listen for once. In fact, I didn't really feel guilty at all. He insisted I book this honeymoon trip. Insisted. In that warm, honey voice of his. If he weren't so darn pushy, I'd be panting after him myself. That and his humanness. Of course, I am saving myself for a ferryman, not a vulgar human man. Not to mention the fact my parents would totally wig out if I had told them I was in an interspecies relationship. I spent the rest of the day tidying the office just in case Wednesday brought a flurry of customers banging down my door. I filed, vacuumed, and even cleared the top of my desk. The phone rang a few more times. The first caller dialed the wrong number. The second caller booked a family vacation to Yellowstone. I'm happy to help, but that sort of trip doesn't get me enough money to make it worth my while. The third caller was a heavy breather. We get those a lot in my business.
Wow, that was absolutely hysterical. Keely, congratulations. That really is a very, very amusing story, and I can't wait to read the rest of it.
Why, thank you. As a matter of fact, being underutilized in that story, just a short story, of course, Highland Press asked me to star in my own book, which is coming out in May, Fairy Special Romances. It's, of course, my whole life story. Oh, well, so there are 10 romances in there, but, you know, of course, I'm in all of them.
Are you a fairy matchmaker?
Oh, yes.
Oh, cool.
When I was only 200, I was the fairy godmother for the very first time. Of course, we went to the pirate's ship in the Caribbean to do that, so that was rather interesting. I, of course, am very good at picking out mates for people, you know.
Well, that's tremendous, Keely. Thank you. And I must say, I'm extremely intrigued about this anthology, No Law Against Love. Kenda, you've reviewed this fabulous collection, haven't you?
Yes, I have. I could give you some highlights from my review I did a while back.
Yes, please.
Yeah, it was a very delightful book, and it was my first book by Highland Press, and just really was a great intro into the type of stories and everything that this press out of Florida is looking for. And I'll just go ahead and read you some of my review. Romance lovers the world over can rejoice in this fantastic volume of short stories. Based on obscure and little-known laws, each tale of romance centers around one of those laws. It's a fascinating concept for an anthology, and one guaranteed to spark some imaginative scenarios. 16 writers producing 24 awesome stories gave of their time and efforts to aid in finding a cure for breast cancer. There's reason enough in my mind to purchase this volume. Think about it, 24 romance stories, that's quite a bargain. From breakout authors Deborah Ann McGillivray and Liam Burroughs, to fantastic new authors like Christy Ahlers and Jackie Rogers, there's plenty here for any type of romance fan. And it was really interesting to see what so many different authors could put together in one volume. From Scottish mountain cats and eye patches to travel agent fairies and shady angels, this volume runs the gamut of romance reading fun. Whether your romance style, contemporary, paranormal, historical, it's all here waiting for you. You should get a copy today and curl up on the couch with it. Read it at the gym like I do sometimes, or enjoy it on a sunny day at the park, however you like to read. Just get it and prepare to enjoy. And be on the lookout for more from these rising romance writers. I predict many happy hours of reading from their stories alone.
Have you read this, Diane?
Yes.
You have? Was there a story in this collection that was your favorite?
Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood you. No, I haven't read this one.
Oh.
But I have read some other stories by these same authors. They are terrific authors.
Oh, I know that. What about you, Keely? Was there another story in the collection that you or your author especially loved? Keely?
Keely went to sleep.
Oh, well, we were on mute. My scribe is a bit of a retard with the mute finger, you know. Well, I have to say...
Yes.
That maybe not my favorite story because she's so annoying, but a real standout would have to be, in No Law Against Love, of course, would have to be Sadie, the Shady Angel. And her scribe is Diane Davis White, and known to all of us as Daring Di. While Di is a very friendly person, Sadie is a bit of full of herself, I would think.
That would be one way to put Di. Character.
And what can you say about an angel that wears red bloomers?
Well,
really
she's
a good
a
story
reformed
to read.
Stripper.
Well, she'd go well, I suppose, with Michael the Dirty Angel. Has anybody else turned up? I'm hearing some clicking on the line. Deborah Ann, are you there?
Deborah Ann is here.
Oh,
I finally made it.
Oh, great. Welcome. Well, let me go back and introduce you again, since you weren't here when we started. I said that you were one of the hottest rising stars in both historical and paranormal romance, and a finalist in line for 5 awards. Is that still true?
Oh, make me blush. I'm actually up for more than that. I've already finaled in the Laurie, too.
Oh, wow.
That's for the published writers. I can't speak tonight. My critique partner, Leanne Burroughs, won it 2 years ago. So I'm kind of carrying the banner, trying to help hold it. Although both she and I are up for it. She has a book, Her Highland Rogue, and I have A Restless Night, up for Best Historical this year in that category.
Well, congratulations.
And then I have five apparel nominations. Bad Cat, I thought might make it, but it didn't. It was one of the stories from No Log and Love, but one of the other stories,
yes,
Double Double Toil and Trouble, is nominated. And then I had one of the stories from Blue Moon Magic, Rider in the Storm, nominated. And then one of the Christmas anthologies, Holiday in the Heart, my story Blue Christmas Cat, was nominated. So I had three, and I'll be competing against Jackie in that. She had her fairy story nominated. So we kind of took that category. And then I'm up for debut author in with Restless Night again. And then I'm in one of the 15 writers in Blue Moon Enchantment, and the whole anthology is up for best anthology. So we got a little attention on the pearls this year.
And I understand you've only got 15 days to finish your next book, so we're really on the
14. It's clicking 14. Away. It's clicking away.
Now,
yes, I just finished my second book for Kensington. It's called In Her Bed, and it's a second medieval Scottish historical. It picks up the story that A Restless Night told, the same characters that is in this book you'll see in that one. And so it's the second in the series. And then I have a second series that I'm doing for Dorchester Publishing under their Love Spell banner. And it is the will be called Riding the Thunder, and it's the sequel to The Invasion of Algonquin Isle, which the invasion is a tongue-in-cheek invasion, not a real one. They're light, they're funny, and they deal with the quirky side of people and quirky situations.
And we're going to be reading an excerpt from that a little later on.
Mm-hmm. Kendra's going to do that for me so my voice won't go out.
And apart from your phenomenal luck in cover hunks, I think everybody envies you, the handsome gentleman.
Oh, yeah. My Kensington covers, created under the guidance of Hilary Sayers, S-A-R-E-S, my editor, have really gained attention and given me a kind of a leg up, I think. People always pick up a good cover. And so I've been, as they say, blessed by the cover goddess several times now.
And, of course, you're also very impressive for your insider knowledge of medieval Scottish history and wild pagan customs.
Yes, I come from a very strong background in historical fiction and historical lore. My grandfather was a historian, and I worked with him. And so I have a lot of access to documents and things that the average writer in historical romance never has seen. And you see a lot of pocket lore in A Restless Night that you won't find in most, say, like Llewellyn books or something like that, because this is small stuff that is, you know, garnered from diaries and ancient manuscripts. And I have a little bit more reality to my lore because of this.
Are you able to share with us one appropriate for Valentine's Day romantic pagan custom?
Well, the marriage ceremony in A Restless Night is a very accurate marriage ceremony. It was called the Sword and the Ring. And basically it stems from the dark times in medieval Scotland when, you have to understand, women held the power in Scotland, unlike many societies, which is generally patriarchal. Scotland came from a line. One of the original peoples were called the Picts, and the Picts had all power and titles and lands go through the female. And because of this, she held the right to pick her husband, and you could not force her to marry as you could in other societies of medieval periods. And so the ceremony is that the man goes to the woman and offers her the sword or the ring. And if she takes the ring, then she chose her husband. If she doesn't want him, she gets to kill him. And so technically, you know, it was a rite of human sacrifice that if he wasn't good enough, then she sacrificed the willing king god sacrifice, which is the root of almost all pagan religions. And this was a very real ceremony. It's written about in, I'd say, maybe four or five places you can find it, that it's a very real ceremony that happened in very ancient times. You're talking Dark Ages and before. And so everything that you're seeing in my book has that root of reality to it that, you know, comes from very detailed research.
Well, I respect that because I'm also a bit of a research fanatic.
Oh, yes, you do.
And another thing I've noticed, you have a lot of cats in your book. How many feline characters have you got in Prince
Deborah? I don't know. Really, you'll notice they don't turn up in my medieval books. For some reason, I don't know. I haven't had a cat turn up in either medieval book. However, all the Highland Press stories that I do, each one has had a cat, and then each one of the Dorchesters will have a cat in it. And these are not your average little kitty, kitty cat. These are very strange cats, not kitty names. You're talking about Augie Moggy, Jack, as in one-eyed Jack, Basil, St. John, Cyril, Alvin, Elvis. These are not typical kitty cats. Some of them are big, some of them are ugly, some of them are old. I am very fascinated with cats and all their personalities. Each cat's like a human being. There are no two cats that are alike. And I've been fortunate to have a lot of cats that were very interesting. And I think it draws a lot of readers in. Most people like cats. They're one of the most popular animals now. Although there are more people with dogs, there are more cats, because once people get one or two, they want more. So you're tapping into an audience there of people that love cats, and they, you know, automatically warm to your stories when you, you know, offer them these unusual cats.
Yes.
And I didn't quite set out to do that. It just sort of happens.
Well, that sounds like a very savvy strategy for any writers in our listening audience who might not have thought of adding a pet.
Well, yes, pets are very popular. You'll see some that are, there's one whole series, I think, I can't remember which line it had, with dogs. And then there's one that comes out from Harlequin. It's a running series they call the Familiar Series. And the cat is the main character, and the cat goes from each book solving mysteries and creating romance. And so there's quite a few. Robin Owens in her Celta books for Berkeley uses them.
Yes, and I think there are some Siamese detective
Sheeta uses them that are cats that are evolved and have telepathy and can almost speak, and they're very interesting. So pets can give you a lot of room to help, you know, kind of make the romance special. And,
yes, and also I think you had a tale of a bad cat in the
yes,
No Law.
That was the kickoff for No Law Against Love, a bad cat. In Destin, Florida, the fine was if you've got a cat that is bad, you can be fined $100. And that cat was Augie Moggy. He was modeled after my real cat, Augie Moggy. And in Scotland, a Moggy is a kitty cat. It's like a tabby and alley cat. And Augie Moggy was part Scottish Wonka and mine. And he was like a little pony. He wasn't like a cat. He weighed almost 45 pounds, but he wasn't fat. He's very muscular, very strong. And so I just imagine I could just see this cat that could chase dogs and do things bad being turned loose on this unsuspecting town. And naturally, he's so bad, he's going to get fined. And so that was our first story for No Law Against Love. And
yes.
The cats kept coming after that.
Well, I know there's one author, Sherry Holmes, I think, who has a cat that's known to chase bears.
Mm-hmm.
So there are.
Sherry is Jackie's critique partner. And so it was kind of interesting to see another author in the group to do cats as well.
Well, we don't have Jackie with us tonight. She's
no, Jackie
she's
is
been
being
replaced
represented
by a fairy.
By Keely.
That's right. She's got
I'm not sure that's really an improvement. Jackie's a pretty special lady.
Right. And now, Kenda?
Yes.
Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Did you have another favorite? I know you read your review. Did you want to say something about Leanne's little story in the No Law Against Love?
Sure.
Leanne's stories are very special.
It's chocolate
very
in the
rare.
Afternoon.
I'm sorry?
Sorry, I thought her story was Chocolate in the Afternoon.
Mm-hmm. That was one of them.
Oh, right.
She had two.
That's right, she had two in there.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say that I don't have the book in front of me at the moment.
Oh, well, no worries. One of the laws I was thinking of was it's illegal for a lady to eat chocolates on a public conveyance.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just so intrigued by these wacky laws.
Mm-hmm. This one is from Britain, and it was, I think, on the law in, like, the 1700s, but it's still there. Those laws are very unusual like that. Because, Leanne really took that and did a very intriguing story with it. She always has a very special touch with historicals. You'll see in all the anthologies that she does, she tends to pick time zones of history that is not quite what they would consider the normal popular ones. Because she did a recent one with the Anti-Kissing League, and it was, again, it was a period when they actually put an ordinance out where that you couldn't go around kissing your wives or your girlfriends because they thought it created a drought and they needed the rainfall. And so, it was, the whole town wasn't kissing because of this. And if you were seen kissing somebody, you could be fined. And so her stories are always very unique, very special.
Well, that's tremendous. And it's been a great deal of fun talking about that collection. But now I want to talk a little bit about heroes, because in my opinion, the hero is the most important character in a romance. We all have our favorite romantic heroes. And perhaps the biggest stir I can remember recently has been created by Deborah McGillivray's Challen, or at least until Dev came along.
Yeah, Challen is the one that has the women's hearts. I think I sold my book strictly on that hero.
I think Kelly has something mischievous to say.
Oh.
Well, naturally, I can take credit here. Because who else but me would have named him properly? Deborah named him Challen, but of course, once you see the cover, you see that his true name is Mr. Licolicious.
As in a lollipop?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Give him wings and I'll take him.
I wouldn't need wings.
Well, now, we're fortunate enough, except I don't have a setup. I've got an excerpt where B.A., that's Barbara Ann, I believe, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Is waiting for the invaders to arrive. Is there something, Deborah, that I ought to have as a setup to put people in the mood for this?
This book is... they list it as a fantasy paranormal. It's very light. It's an island, mythical. I made up my own island so I could do what I wanted on it, outside the edge of the Hebrides. And it's owned by one woman, and there are 213 bachelors on it. And these 213 bachelors want to get married, but they cannot because there's an ancient curse that says that the Lady of the Isle, B.A., is the only person that can break this curse. She has to marry a black-haired, green-eyed man that comes from Ireland. And so that makes it to where the 213 bachelors can't court her. She has to find that bachelor to break the curse, or they don't get a happy life. They might marry, but the marriage is going to break up. Things go wrong. Until she gets married, nobody gets happy. So they have to find this one man, and enters Des. Des Michon has a whole agenda of his own. He's come to the island, her little tiny, beautiful Prestine Island, and he is going to ruin it with his plans. And he is coming in, and this scene is where he first arrives on the island.
Okay.
And it just so happens that Des has black hair, green eyes, has Irish descent, so he can break the curse if he gets VA's heart. And so this is where they first meet, what Kendra will be reading you.
All right. Actually, I'm going to do it because Kendra just read a very long passage.
Oh, okay.
Rowena, I mean, if you want me to read it, I can.
Are you sure? Because I know you've been ill. It's up to you.
I think I can handle it, you know.
Okay.
These colds, they come and go. We're all used to them, I think, by now. Okay, well, I'm really excited to read this one. This happened to have been like one of my absolute favorite books I read in 2006, so here we go. B.A. watched the racket outside escalate. The Mourn B.A. Club piled out of the hanged man to witness Falgonon under siege from Viking raiders, first time in 743 years. The escape artists, five foxhounds, fugitives from the kennels, got into the act, yapping and jumping in the air for attention. This drew the Marys and their Tubby Tabby, the cat Dudley. Willie the Rider, Robbie the Butcher, and Innis the Thatcher brought up the rear of the impromptu parade. Wee Dougie McKenzie puttered up on his scooter, riding ovals around the procession, the two-cycle engine's irritating noise the perfect touch to the three-ring circus. The hullabaloo caused the cat to slap the hounds as if the whole affair was their fault. B.A. chuckled at the antics of our islanders and their delightful ability to turn the mundane into high camp. The Vikings' invasion was doomed, facing that formidable welcome. Walking behind the counter, B.A. reached for the aspirin bottle by the register, shook out two, hesitated, and added a third. Sometimes being the owner of an isle where the inhabitants reveled in their madcap, Brigadoon ways really called for that third aspirin. She twisted the top on a Pepsi and washed down the tablets. Keeping an eye on the hubbub cresting the steep hill, she strangled when she spotted the black-haired man at the center of the group. For a suspended heartbeat, she thought she saw Evian. Hope rose, a vision playing through her mind that Evian had somehow survived the plane crash. Picked up at sea by Norwegian fishermen, he'd been unable to recall who he was and it had taken all this time to regain his memory. As her heart swelled with longing, the crowd drew closer and parted. She saw the man full in the face of a stranger. In that breath, she lost her husband a second time. Too much to absorb, she slammed down the Pepsi and fled to the back room. Leaning against the wall, she tilted her head back and closed her eyes against waves of motion so strong it was crippling. The pain hadn't been this bad for a long time. In the early days after the crash, she'd been this gutted. Over time, she'd survived by wrapping her heart in cotton and getting through one day at a time. Only, sometimes she was so lonely. Minutes passed before the droning in her head receded enough to hear the crowd making the wecking ring on the store's porch. Naturally, the Outlanders would stop here. A private aisle, no one landed on Falgonon without registering with the harbor master. Foolishly defying the curse, Davy the Harbor had abandoned the job to go wife hunting in Edinburgh. The task temporarily fell to her. Swallowing raw emotions, B.A. gathered the tattered ribbons of her composure and strode to the forefront as the bells chimed, ballyhooing the Vikings' arrival. The cat Dudley in the lead, three men came through the door, dodging the escape artists as the yapping hounds circled through their legs and tugged at their pant cuffs. B.A. sniggered, surprised no one tripped due to the animal brigade's antics. And yes, it seemed the Vikings had landed. The two taller men, stereotypical Northmen, with long, white blonde hair and rugged face, set to see women fall at his feet, the first towered over everyone. A ruddy cast touched the complexion of the second, with waves of straw-blonde hair framing his handsome face. His blue eyes flashed in mirth as he spotted Janet staring at them in the same manner the escape artist would at stake. Their virile perfection left BA unmoved. She judged both as healthy males, but no more emotionally involved in sizing up Campbell Grant's blue ribbon bull. It was the third man, the one with the raven black hair, who drew her eyes. If a Viking, he had black Irish blood in him, coming through a female stolen in a long-ago raid. Both blondes stepped to either side of the aisle to let him pass, a gesture of deference. Almost a head taller, they were physically dominating, but he was the power. B.A. sensed this clearly, as if both men had gone down on one knee in obeisance. With a panther's grace, he strode to the counter, then bent to set the Louis Vuitton duffel on the floor. B.A.'s breathing clutched, girding herself to confront the invader. Dizziness buzzed in her blood. Then he raised up, meeting her stare, and everything stilled. Not a blue of any shade, his eyes were pale green, warlock eyes, capable of freezing with the arch of his black brow.
Wow. Well, that was a magnificent second.
And a beautiful reader.
Yeah, that was great. I feel Diane's been very quiet for a while. Have you read this book, Diane?
No, but it's on my list, definitely, after hearing that excerpt.
Okay. So if we were talking about, now I know you have, Challen and Des seem to be very macho types. If they were on a reality dating show, which one do you think the girl would pick, Deborah?
Ooh, that'd be a hard choice.
Everybody likes reality shows these days.
Mm-hmm.
Or if not...
I would tend to pick probably Dev. He's a little more charming in the beginning. Challen was more masculine. He was a warrior. He was used to fighting for what he was. He was used to snapping his fingers, and almost the whole world did his bidding. So I don't think he would present himself quite in the favorable light. Des was a businessman. He was used to doing the smooth, and he knew how to get along in the world. And he knew when to order, but he also knew when not to order. And so on a presentation in a show like that, I would say Des would come across a little bit more charming. And so I would tend to think he'd edge out. But if they saw him, they would probably take Challen.
What about your heroes, Diane? Do your heroes strut about with their shirts undone?
Not during the Civil War period. Men didn't do that kind of thing, or you were in trouble, especially, I would have guessed, in the Army. My heroes are all in the military. They're in the Army, and that's their... I guess that's their masculine side coming out.
They're officers and gentlemen, are they?
Absolutely.
So what kind of dating tips might they give to younger soldiers or to their younger sisters? Do they have any kind of romantic advice that they ever give anybody?
Well, in that time period, it would be to treat a woman like a lady. Definitely. You would have to hold your hand out and help her cross over the puddle and put your jacket down over it if you had to.
Kiss her hand?
Definitely.
That sort of thing never fails to impress.
Yes, you have to do the little romantic things that kind of get lost in today's society. Just a little touch here, a glance there, that kind of thing was probably bigger back in those days. They would had to rely on that because everybody was dressed all the way up to their chin in clothing and down to their feet.
Now, did the soldiers in the Civil War have very high points on their collars?
They came all the way up to their necks, yes. Mm-hmm. I guess men of today would consider that kind of choking because it would be kind of tight around the necks, yes. And They often wore gloves, especially my heroes were cavalrymen, so they would wear gloves and the tall boots.
And I suppose they'd have a saber.
that, yes, you have to have your polished saber and your rakish hat with the plume on the top.
Well, that's all very romantic, too. Now, so I think we've already mentioned that. Did you have anything else to say, Diane? I didn't mean to cut you off.
Oh, not right now.
Okay. And I think we've already mentioned that Deborah's been nominated and is a finalist for the Pearl Awards and also as Best New Author for 2006 for A Restless Night. The Pearl Awards, in case anybody doesn't know listening what they are a prestigious award determined by the votes of 3,000 readers who love paranormal and speculative romance. And several of the authors who are either here or who were supposed to be here but may have got caught by the snow were either nominated individually or earned kudos as part of an anthology. We've mentioned Jackie Rogers, who's represented by Keeley tonight, whose Fairy Good Advice is in the No Law Against Love anthology. That has been nominated for Best Short Story. Jackie has also written When Mules Rush In, which is in the Highland Press's Blue Moon Enchantment collection, which was also nominated for Best Anthology. Now, a word about, we've also touched upon some charities. Valentine's Day ought to be a day to celebrate romance authors because they have such big hearts. This seems a great moment to mention some of the charities supported by several authors here tonight and Highland Press, for which some of these fabulous ladies write. I know the No Law Against Love is supporting cancer research.
Oh, yes, it's totally. This book, not just a small amount, but all the writers contributed their stories, and they don't get any royalties. All profits, when they come back, which in publishing takes a bit of time, but all profits will go to breast cancer. The U.S. writers, their portion goes to the American Cancer Society. We have Breast Cancer Australia and the Marie Keating Foundation in Ireland, because one of the writers is Irish, that will receive their portions.
And I noticed that on the website. Now, where can people go to find out more about No Law Against Love?
It's available on all of Amazon, their online sites carries it. So does Barnes & Noble, Borders, any online bookseller, I think, generally has it. I believe Target even does.
So all you have to do, actually, if you've got, like, AOL search the web function, all you have to do is type in No Law Against Love, and you'll get myriad connections. And I have to say, Deborah Ann, you've done some absolutely glorious websites. Because I was surfing around researching for this little do of ours tonight. And I understand that Jackie also has a charity near and dear to her heart. Keeley, is Jackie back, or do you, Keeley, want to speak about the neurofibromatosis?
Excellent. Excellent. Most people have a really hard time pronouncing that. Neurofibromatosis causes tumors to grow in or on the body. It can grow on the nerve endings. And it's a very serious disease. It's as common as cystic fibrosis. It's also as common as muscular dystrophy, Huntington's disease, and Tay-Sachs disease combined, yet people just don't know about it. And so we decided to contribute the royalties to a Children's Tumor Foundation, whose slogan is Ending Neurofibromatosis Through Research. The royalties is one thing, but actually, our main goal here is awareness, and May is Neurofibromatosis Awareness Month, and Highland Press has agreed to jump through a few hoops and so that we can get this book out in conjunction with Neurofibromatosis Awareness Month. And speaking as Keeley, I would say that my portrait artist, Deborah McGillivray, has done the cover for this book with the rest of the totally marvelous covers for all of the Highland Press books, which is just amazing. And we'll have the logo on there. And so hopefully by being able to go into the romance readers community with this information, it's not just the royalties of the book, but maybe somebody will contribute $25 to the organization. So that's really cool, and I am very grateful to Highland Press. You know, it's a very generous company, and which is one of the reasons that it's so good to be associated with them.
Well, that's really wonderful. And now, do we have some more love tips to get away from being so serious? Fairy heroine Keely, were you going to give us some more romantic tips or some more words about your fairy special romances, which I understand are love stories through the ages?
Well, naturally, you know, I've gone through fairy godmother training, so if you have any questions, of course, I can answer anything.
Oh.
To my satisfaction.
To your satisfaction.
Why, of course. Did I mention I have a star in Hollywood?
Yes, you did.
Yeah.
Does anyone have a question for the fairy godmother then? Apparently not. All right. Was there anything else we wanted to add about charities before we move on? Well, in that case, Diane Wiley, will you tell us some more about Secrets and Sacrifices?
Okay. My current book is called Secrets and Sacrifices. It's published by Vintage Romance Publishing. And they specialize in romance that's set any time before 1960. They publish World War I, World War II romances, and just medieval, all different kinds. But as long as it's a historical, set before 1960. And that makes me feel kind of old, considering that I'm in a generation that was born before 1960. I guess I'm vintage. But Secrets and Sacrifices...
Good vintage, though.
There's a lot of us who are vintage out here. Secrets and Sacrifices is about a young woman named Charlotte, whose nickname is Charlie. And she disguises herself as a boy because she wants to follow her husband into the Confederate Army. Now, she sneaks in. Because back in those days, you have to remember that they didn't do physicals for people enlisted in the Army, especially in the Confederate Army. They were so desperate for those warm bodies that they took anybody who wore pants. If you could see, if you could hold a gun and you could walk, you were in. So Charlie disguises herself, and she learns to shoot well enough to become a sharpshooter. And she finds out that these men, they accept her as a boy, of course, because she doesn't have any facial hair. So they think she's a young boy. And she finds acceptance and camaraderie among these men. But when her husband is killed during battle, she, of course, becomes very upset, and she vows to take revenge against the Yankees. So she's out on a mission. So where is the romance going to come in here? Because this is a romance. Well, she meets the Confederate regimental surgeon. His name is Captain Daniel Reed. And he's trying his best to cheer up the sad young boy. Well, eventually he finds out Charlie's secret during the Battle of Antietam, which takes place here in Maryland, where I live. And I've actually been to the Antietam battlefield. It's very... very fascinating to go where history actually took place. So I cover the Battle of Antietam with my two characters. They go there, and this is where they actually meet each other, and Captain Reed finds out that Charlie is not who he thought she was. He was. Charlie is actually a woman. And she is a widow now. she finds herself attracted to Dr. Reed. But like most men, he has no idea that she's attracted to him. And then as the story progresses, things start to happen, and the romance starts to bloom. And you can find out more about Secrets and Sacrifices at my website, www.dianewiley.com. And there's an excerpt on there, along with links to Amazon.com and other places where you can publish the book. It's it can be found at Borders and any bookstore. And just ask for it by name, Secrets and Sacrifices.
It's a very good book, too.
Thank you.
Excellent.
I also had another book called My Enemy, My Love.
Oh, cool.
And I was asked to talk about my most romantically minded character.
Yes.
In that book, I have an older gentleman. He's the father of the heroine. His name is Philip Winston. He's the owner of a Virginia plantation. And he starts out in the story, he's a rich guy. He loses his two wives because during those time periods, people didn't tend to live as long, and he lost his first wife in childbirth. And then the second wife, he loses her too. But he didn't realize what he lost until he watches his daughter fall in love, and she's the heroine of the story. She falls in love with a Yankee, and he's a Southerner. So this is where the name of the book comes, My Enemy, My Love, because she falls in love with her enemy, the Northern guy. So he watches her fall in love, and he finds out how much he truly misses his wife, and he longs for the days when he was loved and received love in return. And a lot of times I think it's not until we're older that we really, truly know what it means to be in love. Younger people get infatuated, and that deep love can last. So, if anybody's interested in my books, again, The Secrets and Sacrifices.
And My Enemy, My Love.
Yes.
And at the end, everybody should know, since the top of the hour, I'll take this opportunity to remind our listeners, everything that we are discussing today links to all the authors. If you're not keeping track of our titles or our web addresses, everything is going to be posted on a special web page, www.rowenacherry.com/radio/. So you can find our book recommendations. And we'll be adding some more information and also links so that you can find any of us and any of the books that we're mentioning tonight there. I'm hearing some clicking. Has Christy turned up?
I don't know. That might be me. My phone line is threatening to go out.
for listeners who have tuned in at the top of the hour, you are listening to The Last Word in Romance. Smartest, most savvy authors and experts in the most romantic fiction of all today are with us to talk about their top romantic reads for the Valentine night mood, what is hot and wild in the romance aisles. We've been providing sexy excerpts, and we will have some more. Opinions, compelling reviews, dating tips, and strong views about love scenes. We ladies can tell it all. And you have myself. I am Rowena Cherry. I write alien abduction romances. We have Keely the Fairy, who is representing the talented author Jackie Rogers. We have Deborah McGillivray, who has two books published right now, A Restless Night and The Invasion of Forgotten Isle. And we also have the noted reviewer, Kenda Montgomery. And we also have the author who was just speaking with us right now, Diane Wiley, who is both an author and also a reviewer, at least on Amazon. Have I missed out some of the places, Diane, where you also write reviews sometimes?
No, that's the only place I write reviews is on Amazon.
All right. Somebody just dropped a phone somewhere.
I did.
Now,
Kenda, I was mentioning your expertise. You must have read literally, what, thousands, hundreds of romances? And you're becoming quite a voice in the reviewing world. What do you think makes a great romance?
Well, a lot of things. But personally for me, what really stands out and makes a great romance is the characters. I think the story really takes off for me when the characters just really speak to me. And, I get a real kick out of first-person romances. Usually then we get, a real personal view of, it's usually the heroine of the story. And, we get a lot of, her feelings and emotions and everything. But really to me what makes a good first-person romance, too, is when the author is written in such a way that the other characters, the hero and the secondary characters, can really have their moment to shine through as well. And that's hard to do. There's a lot of good first-person romances out there, but one that really comes to mind is at the moment is Gina Showalter's Playing with Fire. Read that one not long ago. It's a paranormal contemporary about a young woman who wakes up one day with the power of the four elements. And unfortunately, it's brought a lot of trouble to her doorstep. And, not only does, the book need to have a lot of strong characters to drive it, but of course, it's also got to have, a good plot to drive the love as well. And,
Can I interrupt you with a question for a minute?
Sure.
Does this mean that she writes, I was walking down the street and I saw such and such? Is when it's first person, is she writing as if, or
right.
Is it like Jane Eyre when she's saying, well, dear reader, I made a terrible mistake?
Ms. Showalter does use both of those in her stories. She uses these, her characters use these phrases that, you're in the story, and then at one point it's like, she is speaking directly to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought when I first started reading this book that that would be distracting, but it's such a unique part of this character, her heroine in the book and everything, that it really works really rather well, and it brings Ms. Showalter's own style into the book and everything and makes it that much more entertaining.
Well, now, how in that case does she handle love scenes?
Well, first person is going to be told from the heroine's point of view. They're very hot. And especially with this heroine, with her special abilities, when she's in certain emotional states, her new powers react differently. And, of course, when she is aroused by the hero, who is particularly juicy in this one, her powers of fire really come to the forefront and everything and just really add an extra kick and spice to it, one that I think readers will probably find refreshing for love scenes. And then, just a lot of things about romances these days that really grab my attention.
All right. Does anyone want to say anything about any other first-person love scenes or first-person storytelling?
McAllister is very good on it. One of the writers for NAL, Katie McAllister, does first-person very well.
Mm-hmm.
She came up through Regency Mystery, which were first person written, and she tended to slide right into romance with that. And she did very well. I think Jackie knows her. And she's a very strong first person writer. You don't really notice you're reading I, me. It's very smooth to where that you don't get that claustrophobic, from one point of view, feel from her writing. She's very talented at it. So that there are some writers that can really do first person very well.
And I think Kenda wanted to say some things about Duchess on the Run, was it, Kenda?
Krista Fairchild has a book, Duchess on the Run. It's a wonderful historical. It's different. It's set... wish I had that book in front of me, too.
It was right at World War II, wasn't it?
Yeah, and thank you.
World War One. Yeah.
And,
okay.
Nebraska.
It's been a while since I read it, but it is a very good book.
Right, and just that different setting in Nebraska, you don't see that very often. You don't see very many settings like that in the United States and everything. And the heroine, she's on the run, obviously, and she doesn't want to be married to the man who's pursuing her. And so she hides out in Nebraska on a farm with this hero that is himself, you know, just tortured and everything, and you know, he's got this history that he just can't let go of with this other woman. But then along comes the heroine, and, you know, all of a sudden, you know, she's this bright, vivacious young woman, and she really turns his world upside down. And, you know, she's very unexpected. She comes from a very privileged world as opposed to his, you know, simple farmer life and everything. And, you know, really takes him by surprise at how well she adjusts and you know, can mingle with, you know, his family and the town that they live in.
Isn't he a hog farmer?
Yes. Yes, he does a lot of dirty work.
I think
like
that was part of the charm
the
of the novel. In so many novels, women tend to make their heroine this larger-than-life man. He's a knight. He's lord of the manor. You know, he's the CEO of a business. He's always this rich, handsome, gutted everything man. So it was very interesting to see, you know, Christina's book, too, which I call her Christina because it's how I know her, but Krista's book is her pen name, was that he was a hog farmer. You know, it was so very refreshing to see human characters and more down-to-earth ability. And it's a very interesting read. I really enjoyed it.
And I think you also like not just historical, but I believe you have some paranormals on your must-read list, or some sci-fi. I think you mentioned Catherine Spangler.
Catherine Spangler has to be one of my all-time favorite authors in the sci-fi romance genre. She wrote a book, she wrote a series of books, and they're referred to as the Shielder series, and these are just, to me, have become just really classic in the sci-fi romance category. And, you know, they're kind of a must-read.
People agree with you because she was nominated for a Rita Award, which is the American Romance Society's highest award,
mm-hmm.
for her last Shielder book.
Right. Was that Shadowfires?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah, excellent one. And, you know, she just consistently puts out these really awesome stories. And she's got a new series about a race of Atlanteans, and the first one is called Touched by Darkness, and it's about this, you know, the race of Atlanteans and their quest against their enemies, the Belians, and it's just, you know, it's a different story from Miss Spangler in the sense that, you know, it's not a futuristic sci-fi romance. It's more of a paranormal contemporary setting, and you know, the heroes have these powers whereby they're used at their fullest potential through the sexual act. And in that sense, you know, there she brings in wham, you know, just a really hot new way to involve the romance of the story. And, you know, just when I think that, you know, she's, you know, written her finest, you know, she comes along with this new series and just totally knocks me off my feet.
Sounds like Guys from Underwater are a new wave, if you'll pardon
the pun. The Atlanteans are coming along. Lindsay Sands started the trend. Her Argonaut vampires are from Atlantis. And it seems like since they've done so well, all of a sudden now everybody's gone Atlantis freaks because they're everywhere.
I think Alicia Holiday has got one.
She has one that was on the cover of Romantic Times this month, I believe, called Atlantis Rising. And there are quite a few of them that are exploring this area that's been really kind of left alone for a while.
And Dawn Thompson has a water world hero.
Yes, she does. She has the Water Lord that came out. But Dawn is a law unto herself. Don Thompson takes everything and makes it new again. And this, she took Old Norse lore and used it to create this magnificent hero that is kind of tied to the water. And it's just an amazing book. And then she's got a new series that starts this month with Blood Moon. And she has taken the vampire back to the historical roots, where most vampires today that you see are contemporary vampire stories. She's taking it back to the more roots of Dracula, the very period piece. And she has written this marvelously sexy, dark, very, you know, new again. She takes it an old kernel and turns it into this magnificent whole new series with the gypsies in their lore, and only the rites of the Blood Moon can save the hero and the heroine from becoming vampires. And so each time you turn around, she creates a whole new series. She has another series that starts this summer for Kensington. And this is about the elementals. Each hero will be possessed of a special power. And the first one's called Lord of the Deep, and he's a water-based, loosely based on Scottish Celtic lore of the Selkies, which were a race of men and women that were looked like seals, but if they could unzip the skin and they become these most beautiful beings you've ever seen. And that will be the root for that story. And then by the end of the year, she'll have Lord of the Dark, and he is a man has these most beautiful angel wings, and yet he cannot come out in the light. And each one, there'll be the Lord of the Fire and Lord of the Forest, and each one has a base of elemental to his powers. And so she just totally amazes me how fresh and original that she makes each book, and each book is that much better than the last one. And it, you know, it just, as a writer, I'm astounded that she can keep up this level of quality. And you know, she will have a total of like 8 books out this year. 2 in the vampire series, 2 in the Kensington elemental series, and then she's going to be doing straight historicals on top of that. And she has one of the most eagerly awaited straight historical romance called The Marsh Hawk. It's a highwayman book. And so whatever she wants to write, she does. She's amazing. And
that's
so
incredible.
Just,
she can write so many.
She is just so prolific, and like,
how
do you turn out so many books and yet each one be is like a gem? And so I want to be Dawn Thompson when I grow up.
Me too. She is terrific, very talented.
I mean, she's, you know, got contracts with 2 publishers this year for 9 books. And I'm sure they'll be lining up to offer more next. And so it's just amazing to watch this talent rise.
How does she manage to write so fast?
Well, she has been writing for a long, long time. And she put her stories aside, as most of us do. And so to a certain extent, you might say she was preparing for this.
Oh, right.
And so she had quite a few novels already completed before she sold her first book.
Mm-hmm.
And so she is able to, instead of, like most writers like me, I'm a contract writer for Kensington and Dorchester, and I face deadlines, which I'm sure you know about,
mm-hmm.
is that you are contracted to write so many books in a certain period of time, and you have a deadline, a time to turn that book in. And with Dawn is when she signs a contract, she's selling books that are already written. And so all she will have to do is go back and do edits that the editor might want and then handle the galley, which is the final version, and okay it. And so basically she can, you know, be turning these books out at a much faster rate. That's not saying she isn't writing anything. She can write 2 books for every one that I do. And so while I was struggling to finish In Her Bed, she wrote 2 books. I really would like to be Dawn when I grow up. Just amazing talent.
So just to recap, now I've got this little list here that I've collected from some of the contributors. Leanne Burrows' Chocolate in the Afternoon. Does anyone know anything about that? Is that the one from England?
That's the one from England, where that you're not allowed to eat chocolate on the public conveyance.
And Them's Fighting Words. Is that another way, Leanne Burrows?
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't hear the title.
Them's Fighting Words.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. She jumps. This shows the immense range of Leanne's talent. As Chocolate in the Afternoon is set in England in Regency period, where these very proper manners and protocol is, the way of life for the nobility of England. And then she jumps over and writes this book that is set in kind of Depression era U.S., and she did an amazing job jumping from these two time periods and these whole different set of circumstances. And it shows that, you know, she really has this ability to reach these periods that a lot of people don't touch. And she does amazing stories and such different stories. And this was a funny one I enjoyed doing the cover for, because it, the fighting words was that the lady owned a bunch of mules, and the mules were always getting out and running around. And he wanted her arrested because that you were supposed to keep your mules on your property and fenced in, and she wouldn't do it. And he had fallen in love with her originally, and she ends up marrying his brother, and then the brother dies. So now we're to the point of romance, but the mules is kind of a sticking point. So it was a very charming, a very different romance, because that she does not, she always seeks out the different, the unusual. And really, it makes her style of writing shine. And I might add that Ms. Burrows is also the owner of Island Press. So some of us would not be having these beautiful stories out there if it wasn't for her really tenacious work that she does as an author, as a publisher, as an editor. She's just a whirlwind, and I just have the highest admiration for her and her stories, and thank her for giving me the chance. I've written 9 stories for Highland Press. And yes, I write novels, but I think of the stories from Highland Press as similar to the ones that, like, actors go out and they make $30 million doing a movie, but then they'll go and work on stage and get paid, you know, to scale, like $250 a week to work on stage. And what they're doing is they're honing their craft.
And I should remind listeners that we're listening to Deborah Ann McGillivray talking right now about Highland Press. It is Deborah, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And Deborah has written Bad Cat, Getting It in the End, Double Double, Toil and Trouble, and many others. And we also have with us Jackie Rogers, or else mm-hmm. Jackie Rogers' creation, Keeley, and she has written Fairy Good Advice and Single Girls Can't Jump. We also have Kendra Montgomery with us.
Yeah, Kendra will be a Highland Press author soon.
And looking at the clock, I think it's time for an excerpt again. And we've been looking forward all evening to an excerpt from Diane Wiley. You promised us an excerpt from your Civil War book.
Okay.
Secrets and Sacrifices, yes?
All right. Okay. I'll need a little setup here.
Yes.
This is after our heroine, whose name is Charlotte, also known as Charlie, has been discovered as being a female. And she and our hero, whose name is Captain Daniel Reed, who is also the regimental surgeon, have just escaped from the Yankees at Antietam. And they have taken refuge in a farmhouse in Virginia soil. And this is a little bit on the sexy side. So,
good.
You know. Okay, the sound of trickling water and an occasional splash penetrated his consciousness little by little until he cracked his eyes open, curious to see what was causing it. Darkness had come once more. There, backlit by a roaring fireplace in a large hip tub, was the woman who was calling herself Mrs. Reed, and she was gloriously naked. His eyes popped open, but he forced himself to stay still and quiet. There was no way on God's green earth he was going to ruin the view he had directly in front of him. Charlie was bending over, washing her short dark hair with her eyes closed, humming softly. Her long fingers scrubbed and kneaded through the dark strands, working the soap into a lather. She was far too thin, Daniel decided, but still gorgeous. Pale, wet skin glistened on her lithe form. He feasted his eyes on the beautiful slope of her back and the curve of her breasts visible beneath the edge of the battered tub. By now he was fiercely aroused. He had awakened without any sheets or blankets covering him, probably due to the warmth coming from the fireplace. Unless he moved to cover himself, all she had to do was to turn around, and it would be very easy to see the reaction he had to her. Then she pushed her hair back and tipped her face up to the ceiling. With a cup, she dipped water out and poured it slowly over her head. He watched her, fascinated by the way her back arched, causing the slick mounds of her breast to thrust forward tantalizingly. She opened her eyes and turned in his direction. The deep emerald green of the eyes meeting his was bewitching. Daniel was instantly under her spell. Slowly, stiffly, he rose from the bed and walked to the tub without taking his eyes off the water nymph before him. She blinked. Surprise flashed in her eyes, and then her eyelids fell once more, and her gaze rose to meet his once more. Peace and serenity filled her face. Gracefully, wordlessly, she rose, and with water cascading down every subtle curve and swell, she held a hand out to welcome him, so he stepped into the hot water. They stood face to face. He touched the softness of her cheeks, running his fingers over her lush, full lips. Her moist pink tongue came out to meet his sensitive fingertips, sending a thrill through his body. Briefly, reaching for strength within, he closed his eyes. He felt her kiss his eyelids and cheeks so gently and tenderly, as a wife would do to a husband. But they were not married, he reminded himself. Being in the same room and then the same bed was bad enough, but this? Shame inflamed his face with a rush. He opened his eyes, ready to step away from her and put an end to this madness. But before he could move, Charlie put both hands around his waist, resting them on his hips, and held his gaze. It does not make any difference if you do not love me in return, she said huskily. I love you, and for me, that is enough. She was telling him the truth. He could see it in her eyes. Love was there. Now that he had seen it, he knew he had never seen love in Lucy's eyes, not for him. But did he love this woman standing before him so boldly? She was brave and strong and definitely beautiful. They shared many of the same values for home and family. This he had learned in the past few days they had spent together. He was strongly attracted to Charlie, but was it love? If he said he loved her, would she see it in his eyes? Would it be the truth? How could it be the truth when he was not certain he was even ready to love again? Is that okay?
That was lovely.
Beautiful. Okay. Well, I thought it was an appropriate passage for Valentine's Day. And it still is Valentine's Day. We have another hour and a half, at least here.
Yes, indeed we do. And just to remind everybody, since it's the half hour, we have here Deborah McGillivray, who is the highly successful author of a book, I think we all, two books we all recommend, The Invasion of Folgannon Isle, and I think Deborah, did I pronounce Folgannon wrongly?
Yes, you did.
Folgannon. Is it Folgannon?
Yes, it is.
fog and and also of a restless night.
Mm-hmm.
And Deborah McGillivray can be found at www.deborahmcgillivray.co.
Co.uk.
Co.uk. It's an unusual one. If you go for .com, you won't find her.
So not with that. There's one that has Deborah McGillivray, but it has DeborahAnnMcGillivray.com, and you'll find that. If you just put Deborah McGillivray in Google, you'll find me.
That's good. If you search for you on Amazon, however, there are lots of Deborah McGillivray.
Oh, there is, I think, one other one.
One other Deborah.
Uh-huh. She's actually bought my book. Leanne told me, she says, why are you sending a book to California? And I didn't know what she meant for a minute, and then I realized that Deborah McGillivray from California had bought one of the No Law Against Love books. And so I guess she wanted to see what her namesake was writing. I've often wondered if she writes a review on Amazon.com. Wouldn't that look weird? You know, you've got a review for Deborah McGillivray by Deborah McGillivray.
Yes, it would. And we also have with us Jackie Rogers, or else Jackie's creation, the fantastic fairy Keeley. And we also have with us Diane Wiley, who has just read her excerpt from Secrets and Sacrifices. And we also have Kenda Montgomery. Kenda, was there something else you had to say about some books that you've been particularly struck by or that you found really deliciously hot and wild in the romance aisle?
I think that, you know, if readers scan the romance aisles these days, it won't be hard at all to see that there is a huge trend hitting the romance industry right now, and that is, of course, books with paranormal elements to them. And there is a particular author right now that caught my attention with her debut book, Slave to Sensation. The author is Nalini Sinje, and this is an awesome debut book for someone who's looking for something with changelings, you know, were-creatures, and also has a great sci-fi twist to it with the heroine side of the story. Her race of people is called the Psy, P-S-Y, and it's just a really interesting new book. You know, it'll have similar you know, rings to other paranormal series out there, but she really crafts her story here into her own style and really brings it out and into something unique. And I believe she's up for, has been up for several awards herself for this book in the last few months. But, you know, it's about this world of the Psy people, and it's like a future here on Earth, but, you know, one that's not very far in the future. And these people decide they've chosen to give up emotions, and because in the end, emotions are what get people in trouble. And so they detach themselves from all things emotional, and they develop their mental abilities to the point where they have this huge network that they all are logged into constantly, and they can't log out. It's a very controlling society. And here enters the hero, and he's this changeling, and he's alpha of a leopard werepack and everything, and they have to do business together. And it's just really interesting to see such a rigid, controlled heroine with her sparse utilitarian life come together with this changeling man, this alpha, you know, who's just very sensual, very touchy-feely and everything, and just totally rocks her world, which is already teetering quite precariously because she's not quite like other side people. You know, she's got feelings, and she's trying to hide that because having feelings in her culture can get you killed or, you know, in really serious trouble. So, you know, it's a really good book. I really recommend, you know, if you're looking for something along those lines, you need to pick it up and give it a try. But, yeah, books with these paranormal elements in them just really sweeping the romance industry right now. And, you know, they're taking some similar themes, you know, historical themes, contemporary, futuristic, and they're just really, you know, morphing romance into something just really wild and imaginative and really sensual.
Well done. Deborah's books have, at least A Restless Night, has a heroine with psychic powers.
Both my books have paranormal themes. They're not as heavy as some of the paranormal. You will see the differences of mine is called a paranormal contemporary as adverse to a contemporary paranormal, because my themes are strong elements, but they could be removed and then the story would still be strong enough to support it. But in Falganon, the invasion of Falganon, they have this centuries, millennial curse that is forcing this woman to have to seek out this particular man or her whole island's happiness will not be fulfilled. And there are elements of flashbacks of past lives coming into the hero, which helps him find his way and set aside his problems. And then in A Restless Night, which is the Scottish, you have a lot of paganism and a lot of people with powers. The women of this one particular clan has the ability to farsee, as they call it, the kenning. And kenning means ken, K-E-N, to know. And so this ability to know things lets her see not only things that's going to happen to her in the future, but tends to give her the ability to somewhat read a person's mind, more emotion sometimes. The ability in this book caused her to read the troubles that was within the hero, and it was so strong she knew that the bond between them was so special. And so paranormal, I keep hearing this. I remember like about 7 or 8 years ago they said paranormal was dead, and then it had this huge boom. And then about a year ago, somebody said, oh, paranormal, everybody's done this. And then, and it's not. It's just taken off again. I think people like something different from their normal lives. And either a full-out paranormal book where you have different people that are turning into cats or turning into werewolves or vampires, and it gives you an escape. And that's what reading is, escapism. And so I think this boom of imaginative writers all doing something totally different is just amazing. And it's really, I think, drawing in a lot of people that had stopped reading romance. Because while I love a straight historical romance as much as the next person, some people tended to begin to burn out reading the same style of books over. And this is giving them alternatives. And your books are a good example of this.
Oh, tell me more.
Well, your books are just so totally unlike anybody else's out there. You know, you have such humor and such wit, and these, you know, emperor alien men that are God's gift to women roaming around, you know, thinking they can claim anybody they want.
Oh, and it's a tattoo.
You know, well, you have the tattoo. And, I mean, you offer something, you know, totally. When somebody picks up your book, they escape totally from their problems. They don't hear the baby crying, the diapers going, everybody's got the flu this week. They go off to this whole world of an emperor race that, you know, is going to take them to these planets and places that they haven't seen before. And it gives them it's like mini vacations to these other worlds. And I think as long as the people keep coming up with something original and different, then the paranormal is just going to keep growing. And it's just a phenomenal boom right now in the market, and I think probably one of the biggest growing phases of romance.
Well, cool. Thank you. Yes, I certainly hope so.
Yes. Considering you're selling out left and right, yes.
Well, I'd like to say that you talk about whether Challen or Desmond would win on the dating game. How about the Emperor or Jethro Jason?
Oh, well, you've put me on the spot like I put Deborah Ann on the spot, haven't you?
I sure did.
Yeah. Well, if I were going to be in a tricky situation, I think I'd rather be with Jethro Jason, because he's kind of like Survivor Man with sex, and there's something extremely attractive about a competent guy, and he really does know how to take care of the heroine on their desert island when they get stranded. On the other hand, if I met Jethro Jason for the first time, I would be immensely put off because his language is absolutely appalling. Can you still hear me?
Yes.
Yes. His language is bad, and he swears too much, and he doesn't do all the things that you'd expect a guy to do. He expects a girl to pull her own weight. He doesn't mind taking her clothes off, but...
Sounds like a bad boy.
I was going to say, it's just like the men in my house.
There's something attractive about that bad boy image.
Well, there are writers who built careers on that. Ann Stewart is one of them. We call her the resident genius of romance because that she does these totally bad guys. They're criminals. They're hitmen. If you sit down and made a list of every man that you would not use for a hero, that's what she's done in every one of her books. And so there is that bad boy element that really intrigues women, and especially since you're kind of in a safety net, you're reading a book, it's easy to let yourself open up for that bad boy.
Is that Jane Ann Prince?
I'm sorry, I fell in love with Jason and
Will Smith. I kind of fall in love with everyone I write, and I'm
well,
still
a writer. Should, don't you think?
Well, I think it helps you be a bit more convincing. And
well,
if
you aren't in love with that man, then how can you make your readers fall for him?
Absolutely.
I fall for mine. I admit that I have to love my hero. I might not always like him, but I do love him. And I think that is what I try to build into him, and I hope that reaches out to the reader, too. So if you love your heroes, maybe that's why I love them then.
I find it makes it rather difficult, though, being in love with the hero before I've completely finished with the book and finished editing it, to fall in love with somebody else. I feel kind of unfaithful in a way.
It's true. Maybe why some writers I know cannot read anything else while they're writing a book, that they said that it bothers them, it influences, it takes the edge off what they're doing.
I can understand that.
And I think it's hard to do a turnaround when you're still thinking about one character and you have to start on your next book.
Maybe that's why so many people write series. You get so in love with your characters and you just want to keep going.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm finding a lot of people are interested in characters like Grievous and in my psychic empresses.
Mm-hmm.
So I get mail from readers who want to know whether those characters will continue, and indeed they will.
Thankfully.
Yes.
I'm looking forward. Tell us about your upcoming one. I want to hear about your new one that will be coming next.
Oh, after insufficient mating material?
Yes.
Right. Well,
I have a contract for three more, so give us a hint. We want a preview.
Yes, the next one's going to be Rhett's story. Rhett was in Forced Mate, which was the first book. He still is an ambassador, and he was the heroine's half brother, and he's had a mysterious and enigmatic relationship with the guy that the prince, the emperor, the god emperor that Ginevra, heroine of Forced Mate, married, and his rather strange and edgy relationship with his half-brother-in-law continues in insufficient mating material. And finally, everybody decides he has to get laid because he's just too uptight.
Take pity on the poor lad.
And so I've been researching swords, and I know, Deborah, you have
mm-hmm.
quite an interest in swords yourself.
Yes, I collect claymores.
Do you use them as well?
Yes, I have. Our family was very into swords, so we had an armory. And that was one of the things. Not only did my grandfather want me to learn what the weapons were, he wanted me to learn to use them. I don't do them too good. It takes a lot of upper body strength to wield a claymore. And a claymore, for anyone not used to it, is what they would call the grand sword or the big sword. They're almost 5 foot tall, and they are not an easy weapon to wield, and especially for any length of time. It can be quite tiresome, but it is a marvelous thing to learn, and I've participated in the making of them, which, you're talking about the heat that it comes off the forges to create these beautiful instruments of war. Is amazing, and I really, they're an instrument that, you know, harkens back to an older time, and a time when there were codes, and to me, the swords are just fascinating. Each one, I just could stand there and hold them, and it's like, you know, reaching back into the past. So I'm interested to know about the swords in your book.
Well, I've had to work up a rationale why people would use swords in space. And apparently astronauts, you know, one of the rules at NASA, they're not allowed to take weapons in. Because, of course, if you made a hole in the hull, it would be absolutely disastrous for everybody, not just the the antagonists. And I've been studying sword fighting.
Well, I wonder about, you know, like in Star Wars, they didn't use swords, they used lightsabers. And I was thinking about, I can't remember whether, you know, because his numbers are kind of confusing, but it was, I believe, the third one that had Ewan McGregor in it. And he said, at one point where he's fighting that robot general that had all the arms, and he ends up having to shoot him, and, you know, he kind of goes, oh, so uncivilized. And I think maybe to a certain extent that's the fascination with weapons. There is a protocol. There is a beauty. There is a grace. There is an honor of looking your opponent in the eye that blasters just don't have. And so maybe that's where you need to look, is the hearken of elegance and protocol and, you know, this whole mystique of a soldier facing a soldier one-on-one.
I have researched all that, and also the stories about how the Japanese samurai had guns, but they decided that it just wasn't a sporting way of fighting. Mm-hmm. And there's a funny story about I think it's the Cambridge first fencing team and the cutthroats. They've got a picture there of all the animals that have weapons. And the sawfish, S-A-W, is hiding in the back of the portrait because he has such an ignoble weapon, his saw, you see. The swordfish and all the other beasts that have noble weapons jolly in the foreground, but the sawfish has to hide in the back, which is just... So I've been researching, and I've made contact with a sword master who's prepared to read my fighting scenes and make sure I've got them right.
That's very good.
And I always like to go to an expert. For instance, with insufficient mating material, I went to Survivor Man, who is Les Stroud. He's on television on the Science Channel on Wednesday nights. And every week, for those who've never heard of Survivor Man, every week he's dropped in some remote location and he has to survive for 7 days and nights with only the clothes he stands up in, anything he happens to have with him. It could be a match or he might have no matches, and his multi-tool. And he does it, whether it's in the Arctic frozen wastelands or on top of a mountain or in the Georgian swamps. He's been in some very interesting places. Right now he's in Africa. And I wrote to him and I said, through entertainment, you and I are perhaps trying to do similar things in my own modest way. I want to give people some real information that could make a difference if they were ever stranded or marooned or in some dangerous situation. And he said he'd love to read my book. And he did. And he enjoyed it so much he gave me the cover quote. He also gave me some advice about how to make diapers in the wilderness if you absolutely had to.
That's very unusual.
And condom. And find water. And make fire. Yes, he gave me most of the information I had, but it was really good to have an expert like that to help me out. And I made this point earlier on, just as Deborah's very well informed with her historical information and her weaponry. I like to try and be well informed with what I do too.
Absolutely. I've attended a lot of Civil War reenactments to find out my information also. Talk to the people that do those kinds of things.
I think when readers go that extra bit to read your book, you need to deliver them something that is real, whether it's ancient Scotland and pocket lore, or whether it's Civil War, whether it's in your book Surviving on the Island. All these things become a stronger story for them if you've done your homework and delivered. And I think it really shows when a book and author has done that extra bit, knowing that they're going to give you a really good story rather than, you know, you read something and you go, oh, well, that wouldn't work, you know. You get a sense of, you know, they're into the Civil War as well, and when I read Diane's book, I appreciated her care in detail. And she caught the flavor in the period so well.
Thank you.
And, you know, when I read your book, I just absolutely loved it because, you know, here were all these tips on how to survive. And so, you know, you get that extra plus of, wow, you have such strong research in the book that really gives a good foundation to it. And so I always appreciate it as a reader, so I try to do that as a writer too.
Diane, when you go to a battlefield, an ancient battlefield, or a Civil War battlefield,
yeah.
Do you get a kind of a psychic sense of what it must be like, or is it basically just a field and you just want to know where the walls and the gates and things like that are, and the trees?
Well, the reenactments themselves give you a different type of feeling than if you're just wandering around on your own. When you have the reenactments, you get to talk to the people who do these, and they actually live the experience when they do these things. They live in the tents. They dress in the clothing. They eat the food. They cook the way they cooked, and they do everything that the people did during that period. And when you talk to them, they become that character, that person. So that kind of seeps into you when you're talking to these reenactors, that they have put so much of themselves into this, and they absolutely wear everything that's perfectly right. There's not going to be a zipper anywhere because they didn't have zippers, and they'll start their fires without their layer. And
The reenactors are very intense in what they do. I remember when Ted Turner was doing the movie Gettysburg, and he had all the reenactors for extras, and here they came with their own horses, their own costumes. He didn't have to outfit them at all, and they would start to film something, and all the reenactors would, oh, no, you can't do that. That's not right.
Yep.
And they were like, he said it was like hiring a whole line of historians because they put that much care into it.
Yeah, it's very interesting when you go to one of those things.
Did you
really
go to the reenactment of the Antietam battle itself when you were there?
I saw the reenactment of the Battle of Gettysburg, and, but they can't, by law, they're not allowed here to actually reenact the battle at the battlefield. They have to reenact it on a place where someone did not die.
Mm-hmm.
The reenactment of the Battle of Gettysburg was held away from Gettysburg Battlefield in a different place, but they had the North and the South, and it was very exciting to watch the horses and the cannon, and it was just a tremendous experience. Really took you back. And the sound and the smell, it was just all there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not all the smells, presumably.
Yes, the smell, the men's smell, the smell of the gunpowder, it's all there.
Well, they wouldn't have the smell of the blood, though, would they?
Oh, no. That wasn't there. Thank goodness.
No, that would not be good.
No.
Well, perhaps we ought to just recap. I don't know how we're doing on time. My battery's running low. But for any listeners who are interested, perhaps we should each... if the listeners don't have a pen, the easiest contact to remember is www.rowenacherry.com/radio/, where you will find contact information and links for all of us who are here tonight, and also the lists of the books we recommended and some that we haven't got around to mentioning. And if we could go alphabetically, which would be starting with, I'm getting lost here, Jackie, I think. No, Deborah.
Yeah.
If you'd like to say which books you've been promoting tonight and what your contact information is, and then we'll have Kenda and Jackie and Diane.
Well, I have the Scottish Medieval Historical, A Restless Night. It's a Kensington book. Then I have The Invasion of Fagan and All. It's from Dorchester Publishing, their Love Spell line. And you can reach me at deborahmcgilvray.co.uk. And I enjoy hearing from you. You can find the contact information for me on the website. And I'm very pleased with how the books are doing, and hope everybody that have read them has enjoyed them. If you haven't, try them. So thank you very much for having me and letting me pass the information along.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for all you've contributed tonight and for that magnificent excerpt. And Kenda?
Okay. Thank you also for having me here tonight. You can find my reviews on Amazon.com. If you want to get more specific, you can search by people and enter K. Dot Montgomery. Mine will have the self-portrait, as Rowena said earlier. That's the best way, the most consolidated way to find my reviews, although you'll start seeing them pepper throughout the Internet more and more on Powell's Bookstore's website, Barnes & Noble, Target, and...
He's a wonderful reviewer.
Thank you very much. And then I also am very lucky to have a short story, my very first publication coming soon by Highland Press in their second time around anthology. The story is entitled Mysterious Ways. And I just hope that, that, you know, it's one that people will enjoy. It's a contemporary paranormal, and I'm very excited about it. And like I said, just very honored and very feel very lucky that Highland Press has picked it up, and excited that it will be coming reader's way real soon.
Jackie?
Keely? Well, I have in the No Law Against Love anthology that Deborah Ann also has three stories in. I have two stories. The one is Keely's Very Good Advice, but the second one is Single Girls Can't Jump. And then also I have When Mules Rush In, which is a takeoff on... there's an interesting chicken in that one named Deborah Ann, but we probably shouldn't discuss that. That's
I was hoping we could miss it. The chicken is named after me.
Well, it was a chicken with an attitude. It just, I had Deborah Ann in there as a placeholder, and it just sort of stuck. And then the worst part of that was I had to rewrite the whole last half of that story because she came up with this line, and then I had to use it. So that was kind of a pain. That's in the Blue Moon anthology. I haven't forgiven Deborah Ann for that one yet. And
well, I'm the chicken.
And then Immortalized, though. And, and I'm really happy
people
about
can live with that.
and they're really happy about very special romances with which supports neural fibromatosis through the Children's Tumor Foundation, and Highland Press has been so supportive of me there in